After four decades, Alaska tribes are seeking changes to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, protecting tribal lands, hunting and fishing rights, and adding children to corporation roles at birth are some of the requests. What does it take to amend the Native Claims Act? Who is supporting this effort? We'll be talking about it, and we'll hear from Don Young, who thinks messing with ANCSA is a bad idea. Amending ANCSA is the conversation today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, sitting in for Steve Heimel, who's away this week. And today we're going to be talking about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. It's 40 years old, and there's a movement to request some changes to ANCSA. It's not the first time that the act has been amended. There's been several changes through the years. But this is an effort that's been growing for a few years now, and tribes are calling for some changes that concern them about the future of the tribes and of the next generations of children. Joining me in the studio is Larry Merkuliev. Larry is with
Seven Generations Consulting.
Thank you, Larry. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks to you for allowing us to be here, and good morning to your listening audience.
Yes, and we'll be taking calls from the listening audience. Also with me is David Harrison. David is the executive director of the Alaska Intertribal Council. Good morning.
Good morning. And again, thank you for having me on the show. And I want to say good morning to all of our sovereign peoples across Alaska.
All right. Well, thanks for being here. The number to call if you'd like to join our conversation this morning is locally in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. 550-8422. Outside Anchorage, it's 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255. You can also send email to talk@alaskapublic.org. We were hoping to have Emil Noddy on to give us some historical context of ANCSA and what was happening at the time the act was passed. Emil is in Milwaukee right now at the National Congress of American Indians, NCAI, meetings. His attendance there came up a bit unexpectedly, so he was going to join us and cannot. But I'm hopeful that maybe we'll hear from some elders out there who kind of remember the political climate and what was going on that can give us call in and give us some perspective. And Larry, I kind of hate to put you on the spot to stand in now that Emil can't join us, but talk a little bit about what you know about the political climate and what was going on at the time that the Claims Act was being worked on and what people were trying to do, and then we'll move on to the tribal accord and the tenants there.
Okay, well, I've attended a lot of forums where people who were involved, directly involved with ANCSA, talked about what they went through and what they were trying to achieve. And initially, most people don't know that it was the tribes of Alaska that created AFN. And back before the Land Claims Act passed, in order for them to get involved in the negotiations in Washington, D.C., after the issue about the pipeline and the land freeze came about. And so many of the leaders, of course, never had any experience in something of this magnitude before, and there was no mechanism really for getting direct feedback and direction from the communities that they represented, because things were happening so quickly back in D.C., back in 1969, 1970. And they said that originally when the proposition came up to create what was called Section 4B of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which basically extinguished Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights, they had made a deal with our congressional delegation whereby the delegation said that they would restore it at a later time. They just didn't want to deal with it right now. And as many people know who are involved with this issue, the Alaska National Interest Conservation Act was passed, ANILCA it's called, about 10 years later. And it was an attempt to try to do complete that pledge from the congressional delegation, but it didn't go far enough because that particular act only recognized rural preference, not Alaska Native preference. And that, of course, has been the seed to create all the conflict and disagreements that have occurred ever since then with regard to subsistence. So that's the basic concern of most of the communities, and probably all the communities, I think, in rural Alaska that depend on subsistence for as a way of life. And that way is actually being threatened now.
And we'll get to talking about the accord and how you're trying to address some of those threats through that. I want to remind listeners that we are inviting calls locally, 550-8422, and outside of Anchorage, 1-800-478-8255. I remember hearing Edward Itta, the mayor of the North Slope Borough, talk just recently about he was on one of the ANCSAT 40 panels, and I went to listen to that, and he was talking about how difficult it was at that time to kind of wrap your head around what was being discussed. Because he said talking about even $1 million was so out of the realm of consideration for people. He said, I was working on the North Slope, just doing, you know, whatever the work is out in the field there. And he said he was making something like $5 or $6 an hour and got a raise up to close to $7 and thought he was really rich. And I don't mean to suggest that there was a lack of sophistication, because that isn't what I'm saying, but it was such a different way of looking at the world through the idea of $1 million or millions of dollars and trying to figure out how much land is enough. And so I think that trying to work under those guidelines must have been very difficult for people at the time.
It was extremely difficult. I mean, no one could relate to what the idea of a corporation was, and the whole idea of getting land in fee simple title. That was, again, a foreign concept, and the whole idea of, yes, $1 million, that was inconceivable in those days, because people didn't have those kinds of structures that they had to deal with, and they never did. And so, yes, and it was quite a uphill learning curve for the leaders that were involved in that.
Now, let's talk just for a moment about what the tribal accord is, and then, David, I'd like you to weigh in from AITC's perspective about this effort. But, Larry, lay out the groundwork of what the tribal accord is and what's being sought here.
Okay, first of all, I want to make it clear, I'm not a tribal representative, and I'm speaking individually, but I have been involved as an individual with the accord process for several months. But actually, this effort had been going on for several years. And it's not quite accurate to say that the sole means by which tribes are trying to get redress for the issues that I'm going to talk about is through amending ANCSA. It's one of the options that will be seriously looked at by all the tribes when they start discussing their strategies. Administrative remedy is another avenue. Legal remedy is another avenue. But what the accord is basically an attempt to redress the problems that have been created by ANCSA, whereby, for example, we have the majority of the Alaska Native people in Alaska right now are not shareholders of the corporations. It's estimated that as much as 75% of the Alaska Native population are no longer or are not members of the corporation. They're not shareholders. And these are people that were born because of ANCSA. said that anyone born after December 18, 1971 is not a shareholder, only those before, that were born before. And so what it does is it separates the majority of Alaska Native people from their heritage, which is the land. And the land is and subsistence is the basis for the survival and thriving of all of the cultures throughout Alaska. And so basically, we've created two classes of Alaska Native people. So that's one of the things that the Accord seeks to redress, which is to ask Congress to mandate that those born after December 18 become shareholders so that they have a legal tie to their land, as one of the points. And another one is to recognize and affirm Aboriginal land titles and designate lands as Indian country. It's a complex issue. We have over 229 tribes in Alaska here today, and most of them are landless. And because of that particular situation, the courts had decided that they have very limited jurisdiction. They don't have jurisdiction over controlling their subsistence activities and you know, regulating and managing as traditionally and customarily has been done. They don't have the ability to tax activities that go on their land, and they have no means by which to protect future generations for the legacy that they received from their ancestors that goes back as far as 10,000 years, and so because of that standard. These tribes have very, very limited abilities to govern, and these are the governments that we have today that was created by the U.S. government. And so there needs to be a correction of that to give tribal governments, or to restore to tribal governments, rather, I would say, not give, because it always has been there. It's an inherent right that Aboriginal peoples have. For self-governance, so that we want to try to restore that self-governance. And the reason it's important, there are a lot of reasons why it's important. It's not just, it's not about power. What it is about local control. You know, all these communities throughout Alaska are facing huge challenges. They've got endless increasing costs for fuel. You've got climate change events occurring that are diminishing wildlife populations and changing vegetation. You've got increasing numbers of people coming in, sports hunters, sports fishermen. I mean, I'm not talking against sports hunters, sports fishermen. I'm just saying that there are more and more coming in every year. The population is growing in the state of Alaska that are not Native. Most people don't, a lot of people don't, who are coming in don't know anything about Alaska Native people. And so they don't understand how much we depend upon the fish and wildlife out there. I mean, we consume more pounds per capita of wild foods than any other populace in the U.S., Native or non-Native. And then we've got all these rules and regulations that are passed on subsistence that basically, in my opinion, is creating a situation where it's like a death by a thousand cuts. Our villages are slowly but surely becoming impoverished because of all these events. And we need to turn that around. And then we have some of the highest rates of suicide in the nation. In fact, I think it is the highest rate in the nation.
By quite a bit.
By six times. And so that's because local people are not empowered enough to deal with the issues that are affecting their own lives and their own communities. And this needs to change. We have a situation where the U.S. Constitution and the Alaska Constitution recognize individual rights, which is good. But there's no mechanism to recognize communal rights, which has been our historical basis.
Well, thank you very much for that. And now, David, there was a meeting just recently last week, tribes meeting on this accord. Larry was facilitating the discussion, and people were talking about how to amend the language for this accord. And you expressed some frustration. And I'm not looking to pit you against the effort here, but I'd like to have you sort of go over what you were trying to present to the tribes that were gathered there, the people that were there, and what your perspective from Alaska Intertribal Council is on this idea.
Well, the point of view that we've had for many, many years, and separate and apart from the Alaska Intertribal Council, we've had the view that ANCSA is genocide. It's termination of a people. I should say peoples. Because there are 7 indigenous nations in Alaska. Not a single one of them has relinquished their sovereign authority to the United States or the state of Alaska. The United States accepted a sacred obligation in 1945 when they became signatory to the United Nations Charter under Article 73. The United States accepted a sacred obligation to assist us in determining what type of government that Alaska's indigenous people wanted in Alaska. The United States claims to purchase Alaska in 1867. When you look at the historical record, you can only come to the conclusion that I've come to, and that is Russia did not have the authority or dominion over the land to be able to sell it to another colonizing power. Russia only sold the exclusive right to trade with indigenous people. That's what the United States purchased. They did not purchase the land. Months after the Treaty of Cession was signed, the United States asked Russia, what did we buy? The United States calls a document Memorandum Descriptive Marked AA. We call it the Kostlitzov Memorandum because of that's who authored it. And it's approximately a 6-page document telling the United States what it purchased. And the only amount of land that is even mentioned in the document is 116,700 square feet, or 117,600 square feet of land in what they then called New Archangel, which is today Sitka. And what we were trying to get across to them is ANCSA being that it's termination legislation and genocide against Alaska's indigenous people. And I say genocide because under the Genocide Act that the United States passed into law in the 80s, it says creating conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of the group in whole or part is genocide. Causing serious mental or physical harm to persons within the group is genocide. Removing our children and placing them with another group is genocide. So there's several different levels of genocide that has occurred not only to Alaska's indigenous peoples, but indigenous peoples in all of the lands the United States occupies today. Alaska is under occupation by a foreign nation, illegally, in violation of international agreements, and that Alaska's indigenous peoples, their tribes, their villages, and their nations still are the rightful owners of Alaska, and we have recommended and advocate that these villages stand up, develop their oral laws, reduce them to paper, so that the governments around the world will understand that we've always had laws and regulations to govern our existence, and that the United States, through the creation of the state of Alaska, violated the very principle of democracy. And that is, we were denied the right to vote. That denial was not lifted until 1970. Little over a year before the president signed ANCSA into law. And you may have seen video footage of a vote on whether the people wanted ANCSA or not, and it was just for show. We've asked a lot of people, did you ever give anybody the right to speak in your behalf to sign ANCSA or vote for ANCSA? There's not been one yes. Everyone has said no.
And yet, here we are all these years later, billions of dollars in infrastructure by the federal government, by the state government. The corporations created by ANCSA are doing work in the state on behalf of the people of the tribes. How do you roll all that back? It seems like an impossible concept to even consider at this point.
Well, and when I started talking about sovereignty many, many years ago, I thought it was impossible that it would be even on the table. And I've had to stand up at many corporate meetings and yell across the room about what's happening. And they would try and turn the mic off and all plain of order and all of that according to Robert's Rules of Order. Now, after 15 years of fighting the state over, and I'm from Chickaloon, and we issued driver's license, registration, and license plates for our vehicles. And in 1994, the state of Alaska issued an opinion in favor of Chickaloon, saying that Chickaloon was a sovereign tribe. The state refused to publish the decision, and they refused to appeal the decision. We have found that the state of Alaska cannot prove it has legal jurisdiction in Alaska. They have their military might, they have their guns and intimidation of our people. And that's the only authority they have. We want our people to go hunt and fish and gather as they traditionally have done for thousands of years. We recommend that every one of the villages establish their own law and order codes based on their oral laws that we've had for thousands and thousands of years, and assert that.
What are your thoughts about the accord itself?
I think it's a symptom to a bigger problem. And why deal with a symptom when, if you deal with the problem, the symptoms go away? And we are pushing for having the villages, the tribes, and the nations sign on to a treaty that we've sent out to all of them. We've had, so far today, being that it's been out there less than 3 weeks, we've had one village ratify the treaty, and several more are bringing it to their next council meetings. And we recommend that the people in the villages are notified and that they can weigh in on the treaty, because I think that by joining our tribes and nations together based on the language in the UN Charter, Article 73, it doesn't differentiate between the seven indigenous nations. So we're going to have a unified government, and this is a means to try and get there.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about ANCSA and amending ANCSA and a whole lot more than just that. We're going to take a call now. This is Carolyn in Anchorage.
Caroline.
Hi, Caroline.
Good morning. I was here during all of these discussions with ANCSA. I returned in 1970. A couple of things that I noticed. Number one, prior to 1970, I'd lived in American Samoa for 4 years, and I asked a friend of mine. I said, "Where are the elders?" Because in that culture, I don't care how bright you were, if you were young, you stood in line behind the elders. And this person said the elders are locked into the villages by the language. They don't have English. And a few years later, after all this was done, and I'd say like 15, maybe 20 years later, one of the young men that had been participating in, somebody whose name everyone would recognize, said, "We made an error in not consulting with the elders more closely." But this corporate structure, corporations are corporations throughout the world, and the money is so tempting. The Daily News published, it's been within the last year, the salary of the CEO of one of the corporations that had been terminated by the board, $742,000 a year. That was just one person at the top of that corporation. And that region I've traveled to during a 13-year period, and I've used the honey buckets. The honey buckets are still there. The villages have gotten very little of this money. And the corporations, as the people die that are shareholders, who's going to own that? Who's going to own the corporate share? And over many years, the hunting lodges have hunted and fished out regions, and obviously they're going to need more land. All of the groups that want to come in there want more land. So if the corporations have the control over the land and not the villages, because the villages get very little of the money that's come into this state, can the corporations sell the land? And one final thing, the suicide rate amongst the young men, the young Native men, is 12 times the national rate. So the main question I have is, are they going to have the right to sell the land out from under the village and all of the Native people?
Thank you for the call, Caroline, and I'll let Larry address that issue, because that is one of the concerns that's being raised by the tribes and by the work on this accord, is addressing that issue of who owns the land.
Yeah, just so you know, I was the president and CEO of Village Corporation for about 10 years out on St. Paul Island, and I was also chairman of the board of a regional corporation, the Aleut Corporation. And there are vulnerabilities in terms of possible loss of land, and they're real. One of which is, we've seen so many multinational corporations that could not fail, quote unquote, that did fail, and our corporations are equally vulnerable to the global economy. It's possible that some of our corporations go bankrupt. And if they go bankrupt, of course, the debtors, if they don't go into reorganization, will attach the assets and the main asset of these corporations, besides any money they may have accrued and investments they have, is the land. So it's vulnerable there. If the state legislature decides to organize unorganized boroughs, and become boroughs, and the basis for borough survival financially is taxing the land. And if the corporation don't have the money to do it, particularly village corporations, they could lose the land there. And they can outright sell it, because this land is fee simple title land. They can do with it whatever they want. And as I understand it, there have been some corporations that have actually sold parts of their land. So, and the whole point is, the land is the basis for our survival, and that's how we survived and thrived in Alaska for 10,000 years. We lose that land base, and we're gone. So it's a question of survival. It's life and death, and it's a big moral issue.
We're going to be taking a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear Don Young's perspective. We have a bit of tape with Don Young. I had invited Congressman Young to come on the program, but I didn't get a response back. And we do have a bit of tape with him. We'll be listening to that. And then I'd like to talk a little more about what the situation is currently with young people on the corporation rolls, so that we have a better understanding of what that means and why up to 75% of young people aren't on the rolls at all any longer. We'll be talking about those things. We'll be taking your calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years. And by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we're talking about ANCSA and amending it and whether it should be in place at all. The number to call if you'd like to join the conversation locally is 550-8422, 550-8422. Out of the Anchorage area, it's 1-800-478-8255, 800-478-8255. Now we're going to take a caller. This is Martha in Anchorage, and she's got a comment on the cost of colonization. Hi, Martha.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just listening to Larry before the break, and he mentioned that there, one concern might be the state pushing for unorganized boroughs. And I find that kind of ironic because after 1971, the North Slope Borough was formed, and the state of Alaska fought the formation of the borough because they didn't want to have a dent put into their own tax, taxing of the pipeline and infrastructure in Prudhoe Bay in our my ancestral homeland. And I studied history in college, and I studied other parts of the world, the process of colonization, and I see what happened in other places. You have the creation of a native bureaucracy through this the corporate structure, and you have a creation now too of a native elite, and the interests of the native elite aren't necessarily those of the people. And speaking, there's some alienation that happens with the creation of a native elite, and then we're having like with other places, you have a bit of a you have a void that happens, and you have people stepping forward, like in what happened in the Arab Spring, where you have the intellectuals look around and they say, you know, people who think, who is speaking up for what's right or what's wrong, and who is speaking up for the truth or speaking up for the people, and so then you have Native intellectuals start to emerge as voices, and I think we're in the early stages of that. And David going off and getting I believe you got your law degree, David, or you were studying law. He's one of the ones who educated himself and came back, and he's serving his people, and he's trying to probably resurrect a corporation, a nonprofit corporation that was attacked for years by the for-profit corporations because they did not want to compete. They did not want the Alaska Intertribal Council and the Native tribal group that preceded that. They didn't want them to compete with Congress, at the congressional level for tribal interests. So, a couple of years ago, I went down to the courthouse here in Anchorage, and I sat in on the Cook Inlet Region Incorporated versus a contractor, one of their partners, and the partnership broke up. And I was so surprised to see practically the whole Cook Inlet Region board there. And I asked one of the board members, what are you doing here? And the board member said he's trying to find out what's happening with his corporation. So I think some of the solutions that we can put into place, look what happened in Greenland. They had a vote of the people where 3/4 of the people voted to create an independent government, independent of Denmark. in we've had the in creation of a group called the ANCSA CEOs and Presidents. They're a heavy hitting group. They're pretty much behind the scenes, but they make policy. They make decisions for the corporations, what they want to do before Congress and out in the public, and what they know, how they can, what they've learned to help themselves, maybe at the expense of the shareholders. I think what one thing Congress could do would be to amend the act to make a place for an organization where we have like a statewide shareholders group, where we have some power that is not just volunteers struggling to promote their causes and their just causes. So we could have something like that going on. And then we could also do, for one more thing that's important that people have talked about, why not put the contracting, the 8A contracting, the minority contracting for disadvantaged groups, why not have, if the Native corporations want to participate in that, then remove the exemption for the Securities and Exchange Commission oversight. Right now, none of the Native corporations are overseen by this SEC because Congress created the corporations for that kind of oversight. And in doing so, they've created a black hole where American taxpayers' money is going, and American taxpayers should be rightly concerned about the corporations. There are solutions where you can have minority contracting, but it should be a transparent process.
Okay, thanks, Martha, for those thoughts. She threw a lot at us, and I appreciate your thoughts on several of those issues. She raised an interesting point about Greenland and the vote that the people had there to be free of the rule of Denmark. And I talked to someone recently who is a resident of Greenland, and she said that it's been very successful, that the people are doing well with self-governance, that that there's a lot going on that they're proud of, and they feel like they're going to have good success into the future. I don't know if a similar model has been considered here, or if people think along those lines. We're going to take one more call, and then we'll talk a little bit more about those issues. Alan in Point Baker. Hi, Alan.
I came to Alaska about 40 years ago, and I'd like to see some self-sufficiency among the natives of Alaska. When I came in 71, ANCSA was being debated in Congress, and I think self-sufficiency is much better than freeloading, and I think that self-sufficiency existed to a large extent before ANCSA, but it's gone the other way now. We've got cradle-to-grave health care. We've got the 8A contracting program the previous commentator talked about, which brought in about $25 billion. Very little of that money goes to the shareholders. $1 billion from ANCSA, 45 million acres, and now we got Sea Alaska Corporation back in D.C. trying to get more than the land that they were ever entitled to, because let's face it, the towns before contact were very small areas. We had 5,000 people at the time of 1867 when the Russians gave Alaska to the United States. There were 5,000 Tlinkets and Haidas living in maybe 20 villages. They didn't occupy 32 million acres, as Sea Alaska is saying. They only occupied very small land area. So what they got in ANCSA was well over 1,000 square miles. And now they're back in Congress. They want more than that. They want the best bays for lodges. The U.S. Forest Service is adequately protecting the cultural resources, and yet they want them for tourist groups. And so there's a big rebellion going on in Southeast Alaska. Many natives are opposed to the Sea Alaska Bill because in Huna they destroyed the whole area by logging 12 miles. Just look at Huna's legacy. In Sitka there's an uproar. The city council is not at all happy that Sea Alaska wants Redoubt Bay. On Prince of Wales Island, there were 9 towns that were opposed to Sea Alaska getting selections in the best remaining old-growth forest. They want over 200 miles of roads that taxpayers paid for. The roads themselves are probably worth $100 million, and the bridges are worth another $100 million. Why should the taxpayers be given $200 million to a for-profit corporation, which is sort of like a mafia? You've got the same old guys and nepotism. You've got Kukesh and Byron Malott. Their kids work for the executive corporation. They've got about 50 people there. They flew first class to D.C. There were about 18 people who flew first class. They live high off the hog, whereas the people in the villages get a couple hundred dollars a year as a result of all their for-profit contracting. Sea Alaska is getting a lot of federal contracts. Sea Alaska is getting money for
Alan. I think we got your point about Sea Alaska, and I'd like to allow our guests now to respond to some of those, especially about the the issue of land selections and what Sea Alaska's looking for. It's my understanding that they're not looking for more land. They're looking for selections outside the selections that they have a right to that are outside of the original ANCSA boundaries. Is that correct, Larry, or what's going on there?
Yeah, that's correct. I don't want to get into the issues down there that the people are talking about, where there's a lot, there may be a lot of conflict, but it's up to them in their region to resolve those issues. You know, you're right. I mean, see, Alaska has a certain amount of allocation of land that they have a right to select from. What they're looking for is land that have been outside of designated areas where they could select, but it's not more than what they're entitled to. So that's one issue. On the cradle to, he raised a lot of issues. You know, the cradle to grave health care, this is something that comes up all the time.
Yes.
Alaska Native people get free health care. That is not true. The U.S. government made an agreement with indigenous peoples in the U.S. That because of what has happened in the past, because of the colonization, because of the death of people, because of the loss of land, one of the things the U.S. government agreed to do is provide as compensation, if you could ever compensate that, which I don't think you can, is to provide that health care. So that was bought with the blood of indigenous peoples. And with regard to the issue of self-sufficiency, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, all of our communities were self-sufficient in the past and had been for thousands of years, actually. And I don't think he's correct in terms of the numbers of people. I mean, I've heard estimates. I know amongst my people, the Ali people, we had about 20,000 to 30,000 people. We had the most densely populated linear mile of shoreline in the U.S. Or North America before the Russians arrived. The Tlingit people estimate that there may have been as many as 300,000 Tlingit people before all the great deaths occurred out there historically. So the numbers of people were huge, and yet we were self-sufficient. And now we are becoming impoverished. I think the statistics will demonstrate that most of our villages are barely making its way. And what we're calling for are solutions that allow local control and self-determination and the ability to access our customarily and traditionally used lands and the traditional ways of managing and accessing fish, wildlife, and habitat.
1-800-478-8255 or locally 550-8422. We're talking about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And I want to have you explain a little bit about this issue with shares and children, what were known as afterborns in the Claims Act from 1971. Why is it, do you have an understanding of why that was put into place in the first place? Why was it decided to cut it off at a certain date? What was going on with that idea?
I'm sure there must be a history to it that I'm not familiar with, but I think the idea of at least one of the ideas may be from a business standpoint, if you have an endless number of growing shareholders, what do you do in terms of the par value of the stock? So it probably was a Western business construct or consideration. They did not think about future generations and how our young people will be disenfranchised from their, not only their corporation, but their ancestral lands.
Do you have a thought on that, David?
Well, tribal peoples, whether they be here in Alaska, Hawaii, Canada, Lower 48, Central South America, you know, we didn't put a number on our people. And then in my language, that was Ngi, offensive to the spirit. And in our village, we don't recognize a blood quantum. It's lineal descendancy. Most of the people in my village are descendant from three women. My grandmother and her two sisters. And we have grown in number. And so whenever it comes to ANCSA and the termination of our children, you know, that's just sacrilegious.
The issue of blood quantum is one that I wanted to ask about also. Is there a mandate in place in the corporations now that you have to be a quarter blood, or is there that requirement currently?
Okay. Yes, ANCSA provide that requirement that you can enroll in the corporation during the formative days of these corporations. You can enroll in the corporation if you're a one-quarter blood quantum and you're a member of one of the tribes in the communities. And David brings up a very valid point, and that is that, you know, we have to find ways, at least from the Alaska Native community standpoint, to make sure that we are inclusive of our younger, of our coming generations. And the tribes have their own ordinances and qualifications. Most tribes don't use blood quantum. They, like David said, they use lineage. So it keeps people in the fold and helps to maintain and strengthen the cultures from which they come.
Well, I know that the concept of blood quantum measurement was, I believe, started from the federal government when they created the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and that was this construct that they put on things. And as you noted, it immediately disenfranchised a certain percentage of people right away when you set up the corporations. What is the current way in which someone born after 1971 can have shares? How does that work?
Through inheritance of stock is the primary way when someone dies and they inherit it. But that is problematic over time, as well as the blood quantum issue. Because if you look at, let's say, 15, 20 generations down the line, it's possible that most Alaska Native people will not have one-quarter blood, in which case, what do you do? And through the inheritance process, you know, many people may not be familiar with the Indian Allotment Act, but there are allottees down there in the lower 48 where they're 1/1000th of an owner after a couple of hundred years or 150 years of having
fractionated allotment. Shares.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. shares will end up the same way, to the point that, you know, 100 years from now, you might have 1/1000th of one share. Which would be ludicrous, because what that does is again, disempowers people in terms of their voice in the instrument that is now greatly affecting their lives.
We're going to have to take a break here in just a moment, but if someone inherits shares, do they have the same rights as the original shareholder had that passes those shares on? Can they then pass them on to their children and their grandchildren? So they retain the same rights with those shares?
Not all of the same rights. It depends on who they are. If a non-Indigenous person gets any of those shares, those shares, as far as I understand, become non-votable. If it's an Indigenous person, I believe those shares are still votable, but I don't keep up with ANCSA that much anymore.
What's your understanding of that, Larry?
Well, ownership it's a form of property right, and you can't disenfranchise the person who legally receives the shares from their property right. So my understanding is anyone who receives any of these shares that are issued now have the right to vote, but they have a right to vote to the extent that they've been diminished because of inheritance with other people involved. But they do have that, and each corporation, of course, has the right to look at different classes of stock.
We'll continue this discussion. An hour isn't long enough, that's for sure. But we'll take some calls when we come back after a short break when Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
We are running out of time quickly, and there's a lot more to discuss on this issue. But right now we're going to hear from Don Young. He's talking to Libby Casey, APRN's D.C. correspondent. She asked him about the issue of taking land into trust based on some of the amendment language that's in the U.S. House right now.
We are a different situation. This is the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act, which has created ANSCA, and it's the corporate profit, nonprofit organization, which works a lot better than reservations. I've been visiting reservations now, and it's been a disaster. Why anybody want to put land into trust, I have no idea, because it means you're under the Big Father. And Big Father has not done well by the American Natives.
She sent me an article saying that some tribes want to.
They really want to break down ANSCA. And I'm not for that, will not be for it.
How does this bill look? I mean, this is in the Natural Resources Committee?
It's the Natural Resources Committee, and we're going to do a lot of work on it. I'm not confident it's necessary to have the bill. Some tribes in the lower 48 want it, and I'm listening to them. We're going to have a hearing on it. But I'm not overly excited about doing everything. But if they were to do something, it means that very frankly, the Alaska is going to be excluded. And for those that don't like that, I understand it. But I have spent too much time working with Alaska Native corporations, Alaska Village corporations, to have that program destroyed. It was the finest settlement we've ever had, and it's worked.
And so you see people, tribes who want to put their land into trust as really being
You have surface land and subsurface land. Subsurface owned by the corporations. You put the surface into trust of the federal government, that means that nothing can be done with what belongs to the Native corporation itself, which means all the shareholders of that corporation. It's just not one village.
And so this will probably come before your subcommittee.
Oh, it is before.
I mean, that's yeah. Where that you have jurisdiction. Yeah. So if the lower 48 tribes can, is it okay if they put lands in a trust? I mean,
See, this is why I don't know why they would want to, because most of their land is in trust already, and that's why they have such a terrible problem. They can't even build an outhouse without going to the BIA and getting a permit. They can't do anything. And I don't know why anybody had wanted to do it.
That's Congressman Don Young talking about his ideas on taking land into trust. And David, you had some comments before the break that you wanted to make.
Well, first, after hearing Congressman Young talk about lands into trust, there is a big difference between a traditional government and a federal corporation. The federal corporations are organized under the 1936 or 1934 Indian Reorganization Act. Those forms of reorganization are merely federal corporations. And yes, they do have to go and ask the Secretary of Interior at every move they make. And they can resolve that by holding an election and removing that clause that states they have to go on to the Interior Department to do anything on their lands held in trust or what have you. A traditional government never gave up anything. They never gave their authority to the United States or any other foreign entity. They still hold their inherent right to govern. I wanted to respond to some of the comments that Marge made. And first of all, as for the Alaska Intertribal Council, since I have been the executive director beginning in January 4th, we have moved AITC from a 501c3 corporation to a tribal organization chartered by the tribes. And there's a big difference between a 501c3 and a tribal organization. And so we're moving the organization into a truly representing or advocating for the federally recognized sovereign Alaska tribes and peoples. So we're moving in that direction, and we need the support of the tribes in order to be successful. And that's why we sent them out this treaty that we sent them out, requesting that they review it, talk to their tribal citizens, and hopefully ratify that treaty so that we can start and begin to determine our own future and stop allowing the foreign occupiers to tell us what to do.
Well, I want to let folks know in the last moment here that the language of the amendment that Congressman Young was talking about is a House Bill 1291. It's a bill to amend the Indian Reorganization Act, the Act of June 18, 1934, to reaffirm the authority of the Secretary of the Interior to take land into trust for tribes except in Alaska. And that's what the language is in this bill. They're looking to reaffirm that authority except here in the state. And that is currently in the House Natural Resources Committee, is my understanding, is where that's at currently. I want to thank you, Larry Merkuliev, for coming on and helping us understand the tribal accord. Thank you, David Harrison, for being on to help us understand AITC, Alaska Intertribal Council's thoughts on sovereignty. Thanks to our callers. Sorry we didn't get to all of them. Thank you to our engineer, Dave Waldron, and also Heather Arano and Josh Edge on phones. Thanks for listening. Steve Heimel will be back next week on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.